1, 2, 3, 4.
Guggenheim Abu Dhabi, it is a unique concept. And the idea behind the building itself, it's a dance. It's a living building because it's a dance between spaces. It's a dance between blocks of spaces and shapes and cones. And it's an inspiring for the future because the legacy is a huge factor for every project. It's the legacy for young architects and for other architects. It gives them the space to think and dream more and to feel that it can be possible. And don't be shy, present more bold ideas that can inspire creativity, because you can't see this building and walk in without feeling like you want to be creative as well.
Art museums have long been pillars of culture, but they're now at a critical juncture, navigating a new era defined by artificial intelligence, immersive technology, and the shifting habits of a global audience. The challenge is immense. How do you honor artistic tradition while building a museum for the future? On Saadiyat Island, Abu Dhabi is answering this question in a dramatic way with the Guggenheim Abu Dhabi. Designed by the visionary architect Frank Gehry, this $1 billion project is more than just a new museum. It's a statement, a new cultural superpower announcing itself on the world stage. It will be the largest contemporary art museum in the world, several times larger than the Guggenheim in New York and Bilbao, and a key part of their constellation of museums. In the lead up to its opening, the Guggenheim Abu Dhabi is embracing a new vision, moving from an exhibition economy to an experience economy, where art becomes a conversation, a laboratory for ideas at the intersection of creativity and technology. Amir Hussain is the digital media manager for the Guggenheim Abu Dhabi, and with a background in major broadcasting from the FIFA World Cup to the Olympic Games, he's bringing a unique perspective to digital storytelling in the arts. We'll talk to him about his journey and how he's helping shape the digital narrative for this landmark museum. Amir Hussain, welcome to The Creative Process.
Thank you for having me, Miriam. It's a pleasure. It's an honor for me to be with you today.
So it's, as I said, the largest Guggenheim museum ever, huge project, and more than a museum. You know, museums have always been these spaces for connecting people, fostering knowledge and encouraging dialogue. The Solomon R. Guggenheim Foundation has this rich legacy through its museums in New York, Venice, Bilbao, and now Abu Dhabi. So how do you see Guggenheim Abu Dhabi being different? You know, the museum is part of this larger complex of arts and cultural institutions on Saadiyat Island, extending appeal to international tourists, but also being a hub for creatives and a learning laboratory as well, research facilities. So as I understand, the museum's collection will be focusing on the modern and contemporary art from West Asia, North Africa, and South Asia. How do you envisage Guggenheim transforming Abu Dhabi into a global cultural superpower?
As you said, I come from a different background. And when I joined the art and culture community and the sector, it was new to me and it took me a while to get to understand the operation side, the logistical side, and how the thinking and the creativity happens. We have the team that is working on building and creating and curating every piece of every gallery and the exhibitions and the commissions. They have been working, studying and researching for years. The project idea, as time ago, as you can see, it started more than 12 years ago. And it had the ups and downs, poses. So you are talking about a legacy of research and curatorial research that have been going for years and years and years, and the collection that have been acquired over a period of time. And I got to learn this and I got to understand the magnitude and the scale of how important it is. But fast forward, and I tell you about how I see after 1 year with the project now that it is extremely difficult to be creative and innovative in the museum world right now, especially when you have a name like a legacy name. I think it's slightly easier for other institutions that are new or starting from inception to become creative. We have seen it in other countries, but this project specifically, it is a collaboration between Abu Dhabi, which wants to establish its presence in the culture world, and Guggenheim, which is navigating a completely new territory where they are building a huge museum from scratch. The creativity is there. You have the space to be creative. You have a space to try things that have never been tried. And our director always talks about that. And she is carrying the responsibility and working with the team in Abu Dhabi from the team of the Department of Culture and Tourism here in order to deliver something that carries the magnitude of the name of Guggenheim while trying to deliver new innovations and try to be creative and try to find what can work, what cannot, because you are living in a time now with AI and the creative industries around it, where things change every day in terms of whatever you can come up with now, it's going to be outdated next month and so on. So you want to test something, but you don't want to be left out, but you also don't want to go forward too much that it alienates yourself from the community and the sector. And I thought it's a straightforward process. But when you sit down and I attend meetings and I sit with the curatorial team or the people in the outreach or the public engagement, it is extremely sensitive when you have a big legacy name. And it's extremely important that you also push forward, move things forward, try to do something different so you can lead by example. And this is what everyone wakes up every day, comes to work, and they will have one aim and one dream is like, we want to deliver something that have never been done before, but also protect the community around us, represent the local community of artists, represent the regional artists like West Asia, like when you say Wanasa, like North Africa. So we want to incubate all these talents and artists, young and legacy artists. And of course, that part of what I do is the digital concept of it. And this is where it's really hard because I'm coming from a certain sector where in sports, if it's something new, you have to deploy it. Whether it works or not, no one will remember if it didn't work because you're going to come up with a new idea every day and you're going to fail. You're going to stand up and try again and again and again. While here, it is all eyes on you, something that's never been done before. And you have to be really careful with what you're going to utilize, what you're going to use, what technology can you think it can work. So it comes down to the philosophy of what actually the technology means to the art and what can it bring to the audience and the visitors.
And that's that interactive quality. We already saw how, like in Bilbao, it kind of redefined the possibility of a destination museum. And now with Abu Dhabi, doing something that's never been done before, it's like, wow. So you can build on that. But there was a lot of thinking. So I think that the time for the incubation, the extra time of obviously COVID and things kind of set things back. But that's an opportunity to really think about this whole holistic kind of museum that we already see. I understand it's drawing people to the area already. There's this huge buzz, whether it's, you know, people even enrolling in universities. I mean, I know that you have a relationship, of course, this NYU Abu Dhabi. We also collaborate with them. And, you know, so it's bringing people. It's the ambition is larger than a museum, with the research labs, bringing artists to the region, you know, really, I understand it's part of like even in Abu Dhabi, a 200-year plan. You know, it's not just something we're opening and that's it, show the art. So it's let's talk about the building, okay? Because this is one thing we know. Frank Gehry designs very beautiful buildings. And he's designed this physical structure to be a laboratory for ideas, which I love. So how do you work with that in terms of designing digital experiences from immersive media to AI? I mean, how will that like integrate with into the building sculptural and spatial vision?
Actually, Tina, Maya, I'll take you a little bit a step back to the Olympics, actually, in Paris. So as you said, I was covering the Olympics with my previous employer. And the fascinating thing about it, it was how to use Paris and the monumental and the architecture of Paris. And I've seen how this is one of the legacies that can be used. And during the Olympics, I had lots of sit downs and chats with Pierre Rabadan. Pierre Rabadan is the deputy mayor of Paris. He's the deputy of Hidalgo. And he is the one who came up with the idea to use the buildings, use the Grand Palais, use the bridges, use all the iconic buildings of Paris to be used in the Olympics. And he is a former athlete. He used to play rugby. And he was a very fascinating person to talk to because he had this role, which is amazing. And he delivered one of the most memorable Olympics, I think, in our lifetime would be. And during our talks, he came from sports and he was talking about how he got immersed himself into art and culture. And then every week we were having events, and he is the one who made me see the intersection of a lot of sectors, like the intersection between sports, architecture, contemporary art, culture, all this space where they intersect. And I believe this is where you can be the most creative. Innovation can happen because you meet people, they have different drives in life, they have different motivation in life, different vision about how they think of ideas, how they approach thinking about a certain topic or a certain vertical in technology. And actually, during one of these parties, I was invited for my first interview for the Guggenheim. And basically, the approach of having me, someone from outside the sector, is to appeal to a mainstream audience. So I understood my task, that I'm coming. Contemporary art is might be in the region here, is not embedded in the culture. It's not embedded in the mainstream people from all walks of life. It might be described as niche at certain time. So I understood that my role is that I have to come and to make and present what is happening in Abu Dhabi to mainstream audience. You can describe it as the general public of people online, people who want to consume bites of content and get attached. And then this is where I have to sit and collaborate with people who don't share the same concept, don't share the same ideas with me. And this is the beauty of it, that we have to sit and discuss with each other and have a working group to come up with what is possible, what can work. And this is currently what I have been working, want to complement what is being presented. Whether it's the building, as you described, is really complicated piece of architecture to comprehend and to understand for anyone. And this is what I'm trying to complement it and make it in an easy kind of content that people can understand it, how we can frame it, how we can see what angles we should focus on. And the same is going because if you see the building, you have a lot of steel cones. These cones, they have names, they have numbers. Every cone has a certain view. Some will see the sunset. Some cone is vertical. Some cone is small and you can see a garden. So it's like every cone has a story that we can create. So I'm trying to find what story can help or what can make this complement the building. And of course, the galleries from inside and what is going to be. I can't reveal much, of course, and you understand. But very soon you will be able to talk more about it. And then the gardens and the green areas around it and all what's obviously on the beach, in the Saadiyat beach, and next to us is the Louvre, and the Louvre is like the sun. And if you can, I'm sure you have seen it before. And from one of the cones, you can see the Louvre outside. It is a story that you can create. And the chairman talks about how they are, when they are next to each other and the proximity of each other, they complement each other. And beyond that, when you use the digital media and innovation, you have to like grasp it a little bit and then take your time understanding what is the message behind it, because this message can be dynamic and every day you get new technology, new innovations, you're invited by a vendor or a partner wants to show you something new. And at some point you have to step back and see what is the story and you focus, you put the audience first and what they want to see, not what you want to show them, what is important for them, what they basically need to see to understand what is this, and then put the layers on top of each other and to serve a larger purposes of what you want to show. For example, you have a lot of commissions for sure. And commissions, the spaces where they're bigger than certain museums. It's bigger than a lot of the museums around because the museum is so huge and so iconic. You can have different narratives and different languages about it. And people will fall in love with, because the building is going to be like the Burj Khalifa of Abu Dhabi. A lot of people will come to take pictures with it. It's fascinating. And I want them to go inside to see, to learn about the whole story and the curatorial stories that is created by all these amazing people in the team. And this is where I see that this is my task. I want to use every technology that is available for me to have this step, to move people to go to visit it and fall in love with something inside.
Yeah, it's a dialogue with the culture, with the landscape. The building itself, of course, has elements, but takes it to a different level. I believe with the changing light at different times of day, the art will be transformed too. So it's kind of like a breathing ecosystem as well. I see it as something breathing and changing. You mentioned commissions, and I wasn't sure people understood what that meant. Are these areas within the museum or commissions as you commission artists, or is it both?
So the commission is like a zone or an area in the museum where you bring an artist and they have the whole space to create something from their creation that is connected to Abu Dhabi. And the majority of the spaces in the outside of the building is going to be, I can't reveal much now, but very soon we'll be having another sit down. I will be talking about it because it's something that I'm working on at the moment. I travel all over the world to film and sit down with the artist, to be with them from the inception and the creation of their idea with the curators from our team. So go to their studios, go to the workshops where they are procuring their elements and materials. They are using it for the creation they are making, for wherever they find inspiration. I went to some forests in Hong Kong. We are going to different cities all over the world where the artists, where their ideas came from, we will be with them for them to tell the stories. to be with them till they arrive in Abu Dhabi and start the installation. And it's going to be something I don't think it have been done before. And it will be something that, as I told you, my purpose is to make people fall in love with elements inside, because it's really enormous to fall in love with the everything, to even know what's inside, because it's so big, it's so huge that you will not be aware of certain things. So we're creating small mini stories, mini documentaries about every element. And then you will watch it, you will be attached to one or two or three, and then you come and see him. And then when you see him inside, since you're there, you're going to be seeing everything else, and you see it, you fall in love with it. You go online or you go to the museum, you can see the story, how the idea started, how the artist came up with this idea, what inspired them, and the installation and the process and the journey, the complete journey of it. It's one of the most interesting things I've worked on in my career. I meet a lot of interesting people. They expand my perspective about a lot of elements of life that we are using inside the museum, every element, every concept about it. I hope people fall in love with it as well, because it's the story telling of it is really, you feel passionate about a lot of the elements that we don't focus a lot in life, like birds, the water bodies, the greenery around us, the small elements, of course, the music. There's everything we're covering, almost like a lot of very expansive, and it will touch your soul from different perspectives and different angles.
It really seems like a kind of mind mapping, a process of excavation. We're very invested in this as well, the personal storytelling, because a lot of the themes have been covered, right? If you just think about themes. But when you burrow into why this grew out of a life, out of a region, out of an artist's journey and their culture, and all the threads or rivers that flowed into them, making who they are, making their art unique. That perspective, I think it really enriches the experience. And what I think is more important, it becomes a learning and inspirational process for the next generation of artists and creative people, because everyone has a creative capacity, but they don't always feel, as you say, there's that intimidation factor sometimes with museums, or they don't always feel they have the permission. But if they can trace an idea, they can see where the ideas changed, the mistakes they made, then they can feel inspired to be a part of that creative process too, because they say, oh, I felt that way. And so I find it's very like open in it, and like honors everyone to like to be a part of it.
And it reminds me of something we were just talking with one of the associate curators here, is like, if you have a space for a new medium of technology, it's a new medium like AI, like Gen AI. It's a new, completely new platform. It's a new medium that you want people to set foot in it. It's like, who should be invited first, or who should we have first to shape what we are creating? It's beyond the museum, actually, a philosophical question, because everything comes to philosophical fundamental belief at the end. And then for me, for example, if there is an open space, you're going to invite an architect. So the architect is an artist. An architect, like I worked in Qatar for a decade, and I've seen Qatar come from nothing to become a very beautiful and pretty city. And we would like during the building of, for example, Masharab, heart of Doha, which has like four amazing museums. They are very impressive also in how the building looks like, or the stadiums that we build during the World Cup. When you build something like the architect, it doesn't have to look beautiful. It doesn't have to look like that to serve a function, because you can basically put some seats in a concrete block or a steel block and people will watch the games, but the architect will make it look like sends a message. And the message is the spiritual practice from the artist, from the architect. It's an art. And then when you move to an indoor space and people, you get the interior designer, and then there is a chair. The chair doesn't have to serve a purpose. It's functional, but it doesn't have to look in a certain way. It looks like it's a spiritual practice that you put inside. And when it comes to something certain, a new medium, what we have here, we get challenged by it a lot, because there is a push, there is new innovation. We want to have AI implementation, or the Gen AI implementation, which is not a push from anyone, it's a push from the whole world, because you are getting requests to meet people of the technology and in the ecosystem every day. When a contemporary artist enters a space and they come up with a certain vision, it's a unique vision, it's an original vision, something that has never been created before, after them, a lot of creative people will come and get inspired by this original idea that has never existed before, it came from an inception from this artist. And then you can track to fashion, to architect, to interior design, to furniture design, to product, even design, like any device that we have, you can find that it was originally came from an idea by a contemporary artist. And this is the responsibility where everything new that you have, like a new medium. And then during the culture summit here in Abu Dhabi in April, most of the talks were about AI. I met with an artist called Sofia Crespo, and she found that most people like focus on language models and about AI, because basically AI creates something synthetically based on something we have already seen. We are giving them the data, whether it's words, whether it's facts, whether it's pictures, whether it's videos, something people created. But she decided to go beyond that. She decided to get a microscope and put different shapes and different organisms under the microscope, and this became the language model. This is the source of the AI that she is creating. And she went underwater, she likes diving, and she collected images and she put it under a microscope in her study. So she decided that this is the medium she wants, this is the angle she wants to use AI. She wanted AI to create something that we have no idea about its existence. And she's waiting. Of course, it's going to take a longer time, but this is something that she was working on. And that was her direction. And then you see people who are using it in a different way. And then we have also spaces that I will be sharing with you more about. Hopefully, when next time we talk, we'll be sharing much more about it. It is this medium that we are in a pivotal moment. We have never been in such a moment before where we are approaching something that is creating something for us, but we don't know the usage of it. It can be anything. And they are leading the way.
I'm Patrick Healy, and I've been teaching at the Architectural Faculty and Technical University, Delft, for over 20 years. I'm recently retired. I've published books in criticism and philosophy and volumes of poetry, and recently a novel has appeared, Beyond the Pale. It was of great interest to hear the conversation between Amir Hussein and Mia Funk on the forthcoming museum building by Frank Gehry in Abu Dhabi, part of the, if you like, Guggenheim franchise. And for me, it took my mind back to the earlier work of Gehry himself, who is an architect of startling innovation of imaginative resources, and who has given some of the signature buildings through museums, particularly for what resulted in massive urban regeneration. And within the architectural world, placed the idea of the iconic building as something that all of the best architects attempt to create one way or the other, be that Norman Foster's work, be that the work of Jean Nouvel, which is also there in Abu Dhabi, and which was seen more as creating a kind of new urbanism, as adding a quarter to the area, which had to do with, I think, an exquisite design, which is basically a connection between the sky, the earth, the desert itself, water, fundamental elements, highly geometrical, very mathematical, and in his usage of the dome sphere and the filtration of light, actually an acknowledgement of one of the key conceptual aspects of Islam itself and of Neoplatonism, from which it draws the idea that the sun allows us to see things, that light is the ultimate source of information for us as human living beings. Now, in the Guggenheim, Hussein draws attention to the idea of the digital and of the artificial intelligence as part of the curatorial interest within the project itself as it is developing. So the project has to be seen itself as a process. The energies which it tries to crystallize through its collection, such as it is also a process. And there is a new way to think, inspired by the actual originality of the museum design itself, to actually enter into that process in order to be inspired. I think this is one of the key ideas that was brought forward. Of course, you have the idea of a legacy name, you have the idea of branding, you have the idea of trying to be a sort of, in terms of fashionable responses, immediate, contemporary, relevant. And then the question comes up is, what actually is a museum about? We take them for granted because they've proliferated so much, particularly in the last 50 years. I mean, I know, for example, in Amsterdam, there's a museum of handbags, there's a museum for torture, there's a museum for cheeses, there's a museum for agricultural implements from the past. But many of these are just objects that are being valorized in a very fetishistic way. Whereas an art museum is making another kind of claim about not just the world of objects, but also us so-called subjects who are meant to be either consuming or involved or participating in what is said to be an experience of personal enrichment. And I think it's worthwhile going back to thinking about how the word itself, the museum, probably is a Latin form of the Greek museion, which is just the place where the muses were. There's 9 muses by now, common consent. Initially, there have been 3. There's been some argument about who are these muses. Well, they're goddesses, number one. Number two, their father is Zeus. And number three, their mother is Memory. So Memory is the mother of the muses. So the first thing that the museion collects is, if you like, not just the animistic energy or the creative energy, which we ascribe to the artistic, but it's also the ancestral memory. We are involved in a question that is fundamental to art itself, which is, what is the social genesis of art? How do artists come into existence in a social configuration? And number two, what is art's own relationship to its past? Now, the interesting thing is, this brings up an extraordinary contradiction. It's a very fruitful contradiction. I'm not saying it's a contradiction that you have to walk away from. But art doesn't progress. It's not like technology in that sense. And so when Mia said at one point about, what about motor cars? Didn't we have speed limits? I think she wasn't being exactly Luddite. She wasn't going out smashing the machines of the Industrial Revolution. But she was saying, let's not over hastily just say AI is the only future we can imagine, because art is not the only past we can imagine. It is a prologue to a future. Now, I take that idea from a scholar called Max Raphael, on whom I've worked for 20, 30 years. And I've become increasingly interested in the idea that the first question, the social generation of art, who were artists in, say, the Stone Age or right up to the 16th century, when did they become actually individuals in their studios, in their homes, creating for a market, creating for collectors and so on? It's really very late in the development of art. One could say that for a previous 35,000 years, from the time of the caves of Chauvet or Les Combarelles or Altamira or Lascaux, what we're looking at is the idea of collective activity guided by a communally shaped need for coming together and connecting with things that weren't understood. And this was either through the shamanic figure, or it was through magical practices, or it was through other kind of activities. You can imagine in Abu Dhabi, for example, that if the entrance to the museum was actually a 3D printed reproduction of the cave of Lascaux, so that you would walk into the cave and then you would enter the later way the museums have established the order of objects, the order of discourse around them. Because that order of discourse is really only emerging at the end of the 18th century. In fact, and one of its great bearers is, if you like, the Louvre in Paris itself. It becomes the National Museum. It gathers up all the things that were pillaged and plundered by the revolutionaries from the churches, from monasteries, whatever, and it was brought to a central deposit. But this deposit had a particular interest. First of all, it helped establish the idea of the patrimony of the nation, that everybody owns part of this art legacy. And secondly, it was meant as an active pedagogical center, spreading out from Paris as the capital to the rest of France and ultimately to the rest of the world. It was always a kind of global intention in this pedagogic situation. As you got in the Rudum with its philosophy teaching, it was meant to send those teachers out to the rest of Paris and ultimately the world. And in some sense, that's been a very successful project. I mean, everybody's heard of Michel Foucault, Deleuze, and Jean-Paul Sartre, and Maurice Merleau-Ponty. There's dozens of names, many of whom were at the École Normale. And that went on by purpose shortly after the revolution in the early 19th century and still goes on to this day. And Alain Badiou, for example, is still teaching there. So that's one thing that the museums were very much about. The museion was a place where artists could come. Anybody could come and stay there and work and copy. And it was very much a place of learning. And I think this is also something that Mia said very beautifully, was that the best way we learn is through stories. So I think this museum has to also start asking itself about the story of museums. I'm not saying it becomes a museum of museums, but it actually has to keep asking the question, do the muses dance here? Do they sing here? Is there theater here? Is there comedy? Is there spiritual regeneration? Is there an actual release of the energy that artworks are said to contain and which we can access and which give us experiences we could never otherwise have, and which also point us to something that we, I think, for the most part, have refused to our great discredit, is that our creativity, our artistic abilities are actually constitutive of our being human. Not just language, but the fact that we could make image, that we understood the image was not the same as the thing it was supposed to represent, and that the more it would become different, the more mutations, if you like, that would take place within the genetic coding, the more interesting species being could become. So art as relationship to experience was also the notion of the constant experiment, of a life lived to solve obstacles of problems, to create better equality. And how is that equality created? It's created by accepting the terms of discourse, that we have the right to speak to each other, we have the right to live in a public domain, that we have the right to participate in intellectual adventures, which don't have to be rubber stamped by a particular institution. So it's something extremely valuable, like the pilgrimage, going to these places. The Musaeion was the temple of the muses. It's an old language, but we need to bring it back. Dedicated to the muses, a sense of worship of what is divine, the goddess, the respect of the female within the creative and generative itself, because it relates to our own life cycle, birth, death, but also our need to make sense of our lives as we live it. So I find the conversation and Mia's point about the museum possibly becoming a breathing ecosystem in which all kinds of different storytelling would be possible. For example, in Monaco recently, because the Pompidou is closing for 5 years, an exhibition was hosted, or an exhibition was put in place based on the principle of color, not on the principle of art history schools or styles, but the different color relationships in all the different paintings were put together harmoniously and they interacted with each other. This just took place a few months ago. This is a new kind of way of thinking about the exhibition value and to break down, if you like, the displacement of aura by display value. In other words, no matter how beautiful a Louis Vuitton handbag is, it's not a work of art. And yet I was passing by a cafe in Paris and this handbag was illuminated as if it were a Byzantine relic, of kind of sacred object, exuding aura and proper, but it didn't. And then I walk into a small gallery and I see its small painting, and it's a painting by Georges Braque, and the depth of the greens and the browns and the way the still life is there, it's in my mind ever since. It has released for me an energy of engagement and an energy of understanding as well. So I don't think you can manipulate experience particularly, but you have to, through the discourse around what one is doing, you hopefully create a new medium within the medium. So in other words, the new medium isn't exactly the technical things that are used. And I'll just conclude with this, precisely because art doesn't progress like technical devices. Picasso said when he saw the reproductions of Lascaux or Altamira, which was in his own biographical zone, if you like, because he grew up in that part of Spain, he said, we've invented nothing new because we're forced to invent. We are told not to make copies. We are asked to be constantly original, but that is the pressure of the technological. That's not actually what the artistic requires. Art doesn't displace other art. It creates new art all the time. It is only within the process of creation. It's an unending creation that goes on, and we are part of that, and we can contribute to that. So in one sense, if you get rid of this theory of progress, it doesn't help you understand that the world doesn't always become a better place because we do good things. But on the other side, it would be much more hellish if we didn't do the things that art allows us to achieve. So in that way, I would say I wish Abu Dhabi all the very best with this hugely complex project that's in place to create a new place where art, science, technology, and learning come together. But the learning is itself both intergenerational, and it is about the stories we tell. So the more we could know about those early ways of exhibiting, for example, in the early 19th century exhibitions, often they weren't based on historical periods and stylistic development. That comes about because of art history. You might have jewels, and then you might have a particular a vegetable, and then a painting from the Siena school, all in one space, being shown. In other words, that the whole range of aesthetic value and valuation was shifting all the time. And new artists were coming who had been previously ignored. Michelangelo wasn't always considered in the 18th century. He would not have been considered in the way that Vermeer was effectively not considered until he was really rediscovered by the Goncourt brothers, or Proust wrote about him. So you can say he was literally lingering there, waiting for a curatorially inspired discovery to show people that here is, in fact, a dimension of artistic practice that is of tremendous interest for us. And I think that that's all we can hope to do. So that experience can indeed be a shaping, and hopefully it will make sense for us to talk then about a genuine completion of the idea of an art world. And now I leave you with the wiser interlocutors.
I think all artists have some reservations, and all of us have been scraped without our consent. But I am curious in the pattern recognition that AI could find. I mean, we know the languages that we speak, but now maybe it can be used to decipher animal languages. You know, how do they communicate? That's been a big mystery. Or what is the mind of the universe? There's so many things beyond our comprehension. And there's so many even shades of light and frequencies that the human eye and ear can't detect. So these ways of opening up through AI, able to decipher it, that I'm very open to. So I'm very interested in seeing the new ways it goes, but also protecting artists too, and all of us too, protecting our creativity.
What is your main reservations like?
It's like
the language models are using image from your creation and from artist creation?
It's not my own personal, but that is an issue with visual artists, musicians, filmmakers. That's an issue. My reservations are just general governance, because we are all guinea pigs in this process. It's kind of, and it moves so fast. It's not a standard technology. So I really do embrace technology, but it's like cars, we have speed limits. It's like all medical drug companies, like there's all sorts of things just to protect people from the harms, like with anything new. But if you don't know how it works and it's kind of inventing itself as it goes, that's one of the things we're working on, to just examine it. Speaking with neuroscientists, policymakers, philosophers, artists, museum curators, all these, to understand it, because the people who design it have described it as a runaway train.
When I speak with the team, I say we have to focus first when we implement AI. It's how I approach a new technology. First, I have to focus that it has to solve a problem. So there is a need for it. So for example, I've been working as a volunteered activity is to be an audio description commentator. So I commentate on certain life events for people with visual impairment and people who are blind.
Wonderful. That's a beautiful thing.
It's so beautiful because it's so rewarding, and it makes you like really feel the other people and work a lot, because if someone wants to follow a live event and they are visual impairment, you want to make sure that you give them the experience that they have. So you have to really work hard on describing and giving all the passion in. But for example, in spaces like museums, and especially a spacious museum that would be international, it would be visited by a lot of people, I would love to volunteer and be there, but it's impossible to be available in all languages. So if a visitor coming from a certain country that speaks a certain language, it's like the chances that you will find someone to help you, if it's in English, French, German, it's there. But if you're coming with a language that is not very common in the region, you're really going to be hard to find a commentator or someone to describe the artwork, the experience, anything. So I think this is somewhere where AI can step in, because it solves the problem of availability. Of course, I don't want to eliminate the human factor from this, the experience, because the passion of the commentator is what makes it very special. But if one person is felt excluded, then we kind of fail. It has to be like, this is where I can see the AI can come and help and can describe in a certain way, because of course, do you have the plates now that describe the art? It is written by the curators, And sometimes the language is too heavy, it's too curatorial for certain people. So you want it to be simplified, just an explanation for contemporary and modern art. Of course, it's all about perspective and perception. But if we want to move from the play that has the text, then if we're going to upgrade it, then I think AI is in the front seat of what we can utilize to upgrade it. And I hope it gets utilized by other museums. And I'm going to be giving a workshop next month in Dubai about, I want to get people to be more involved in audio description and commentator in general for all walks of life. Of course, I'm experiencing it in sports, but I am now engaged to be doing it in other fields like art, like culture, like explaining to people needs explanation, description for certain things. I think it's important. And then we can use it, utilize the AI once you are serving a necessity, a need. I think you can upgrade it, add a notch up, like we can, for normal people, for sighted people, they can have the service. It doesn't harm to have something being described for you, because as I told you from my experience, from my study, from my research, the plate, text on the plate next to artwork, it's written by a curator, it's curatorial heavy language. I think it can be simplified a lot. But if we're moving away from the plate and it's going to be something described for you, then why stick to one script? It can be ranges of scripts and languages. And so everyone can be happy. As I told you, if one person is excluded, for me, this is a failure.
Oh, I think that's so important, because we should, I mean, the one thing is, as we're talking or we're listening, we should always speak to people in the language that they speak, but also, you know, from their level of understanding. And
exactly.
I think that, you know, I guess I believe in AIs. What I mean is, like, there's artificial intelligence, there's artistic intelligence, there's assistive intelligence, ancestral intelligence, authentic intelligence. So I believe in all the AIs and not just artificial. I think we should sort of hierarchy, you know, respect all of those ways, because sometimes our technology can sometimes help us, but also oppress us. So that's what I believe. And so there's a lot of people, we've been talking to them, as I said, they have perspectives on it, or the philosophers, the neuroscientists, and they all have a lot of ideas to share about that. But I love the way, you know, artificial intelligence and also just technology in general can make, and this is what I understand with the Guggenheim Abu Dhabi, it's a living, growing museum. It's not like we built a building, we put the art in it, and then you come and that's it. It's not that. It's evolving. It's an ecosystem. It's having dialogues. It's telling stories to everyone in their languages. And that's really important, because otherwise we're just passive observers. And that's not what art is for. And you mentioned there engaging with the local landscape, of course, and culture, sustainability, inclusivity. These are other issues that are really important for the museum. And how did that go into the design process? You also, obviously, the exhibitions and commission.
From a digital perspective and from my side of work, I feel that it's became an obligation that you have to have it on the front of your eyes all the time. How the sustainability concept and the sustainability like coordinates almost, because it touches a lot of verticals here. In my opinion, the most sustainable you can be, of course, in the construction now in the phase, but it's something I'm sure everyone in charge is taking care of that and making sure that the place and the construction of such a massive place can be carbon offset of it is met, and there are amazing people behind it in the building team. When it comes to be alive after that, it is a lot of aspects that you need to focus on the message. The art is what inspires you. So instead of focusing on what do you have inside the museum and how sustainability inside the museum or the exhibitions, so that's the most important thing, is the legacy of a place is what people go home with. And the legacy here can, of course, sustainability is one concept of it, but the legacy of, like, for example, when Qatar had the World Cup, it is how people see people from the region, from the Middle East, and then they go home and they are talking to everyone, and so they change the perspective. It is the message that you make everyone who is visiting. They think about, like, how they can live a sustainable life, how in terms of their work, in their life. This is sort of a knowledge transfer, so it's going to leave a huge impact in them. And then this will shape them by time, and it will make them lead a sustainable life with it.
Yeah, the green spaces are so important. And just going back to Paris and the Olympics, of course, the people coming for the sporting events, but experiencing at the same time Anne Hidalgo and Carlos Moreno's concept of the 15-minute city, which we have with all the bike lanes, even during the Olympics, it's so walkable and everything is within 15 minutes. And that's something that I believe has had a ripple effect with this C40 cities around the world. So you're showcasing one thing, but you're also modeling something else. That's actually the deeper level of like engaging with the community. It's not a building on its own. It's actually how it reverberates into society, into the educational communities like NYU Abu Dhabi, which I know that the director of the Solomon R. Guggenheim Foundation, she used to work at NYU Abu Dhabi. So I know that there's an educational partnership. So it's all this. And then there's the research labs, which I don't know if you can go into that, but this ecosystem. So it's really quite exciting. So what are, I don't know what you could share, but what new forms of like interdisciplinary connections, like between art, science and technology, even social issues, how will these be integrated into the museum's platforms and exhibitions? And how are you documenting these creative processes?
We're a few weeks away from revealing everything. Very soon, we are filming a lot of our content, documentaries. I would be happy to talk and discuss more about that when I visit. As you said, Mariette, she is a sensational person. I learn from her a lot. She is an eloquent public speaker and she leads by how she values education and initiatives. A lot of our team members coming from NYU, they've been working with her. And it is going to be something as innovative, as new concepts, as the building and as the art inside it. It will be something that you will not be disappointed. And I'm happy to share with you more soon. But taking you back to the Paris part as well, and it's connecting you with the education, because in education is something I connected with in Paris. I've never seen, and like it was something also with Hidalgo and Rabadan. They were keen on the education a lot and how they are meeting with the mayors of Los Angeles and the cities that will be hosting major events as well to show them Paris, to show how they can learn from the experience that they have. You can educate everyone. And then in Paris also people like were keen on asking people to experience new sports, because the joy of education and the joy is not in the knowledge only, in my opinion. Learning is, of course, it is valuable and it is to expand your knowledge about certain things. But there is a certain concept and aspect as well of education is like the joy that you get from learning something new is exponential. So day after day after day, you're in this state of euphoria of accepting something new in your life, something that is you never knew it exists or you don't know much about, whether it is practice in art, whether it's a certain topic, whether even if it's a sport like in Paris where you're learning some, you can never get bad at it. You will always be better at this certain topic every day. It's a good feeling to have. It's a feel-good energy that will help. It can push you forward. And I think this is one of the aspects of education and learning that people, how it improves your mental health and helps you mentally to become stronger, because it offsets a setback that you might be having in other aspects in life, whether it's in your career, whether it's in health, whether you're having a setback in anything, in your relationships with people or partners. Learning can offset that, the feeling of euphoric feeling of there is something new that I know every day. So we are, I hope that a lot of people capitalize on this and make a habit in their life to be keen on learning something new. Because even if we have the best programs ever and we having new methods, people have to have the habit of that they want to learn, because they're going to come with open heart and open mind, that they are ready to accept something new. So when we meet them with something they haven't seen before, anything like it, then it is going to be something that moves forward in a right way.
Yeah, I think that that's so true. And what's beautiful about the arts, and each addresses it in different ways, is that we're learning, but we don't really realize we're learning because we're so caught up in the story. And we are story. You know, human beings are story. We're constantly telling stories. And actually, I think it's one of the best ways to teach and to learn is that you absorb a story. You think you're being entertained by it, but you're really learning. And there's so many things that you pick up in a story that aren't just the facts, that aren't just the beginning and the end and what happened. There's a lot of intergenerational knowledge that's passed on. There's a lot of culture and history that's passed on, that's embedded subtly. And the arts, I think, do that so well. So I wanted to ask, what do you feel is the power and the importance of the arts And how is the Guggenheim Abu Dhabi addressing, as much as it's celebrating modern and contemporary art, how is it also in dialogue with cultural history and memory in the region?
Well, it's especially in Abu Dhabi, in the Saadiyat, it's just not one museum. So we're part of a family of other venues. So you have the Louvre, Zayed National Museum is opening very soon, and the Natural History will be opening also after that. And you have the Abrahamic Family House. So when I arrived to Abu Dhabi, it was the first, of course, the first place that I visited was the Saadiyat Cultural District. And as someone, even without starting the first day of my job, I went there. And the journey, you arrive with a mental state, with a kind of a sort of an energy, and you leave with an energy. And what happens in between is your experience, what you went through, whether it's ups and downs, whether it's happiness, memories you go through. You blend what you see with your lifeline, life stories, with memories. And all this happens, and it's curated carefully, and people building it try as much as they can to deliver the storyline that they want to have. But the personal experience plays a huge factor. And what mental stage you're coming with, what's your life was like, what did, have you seen recently, what's in your mind, who are you in love with? And the beauty of the place is, like, if you see it in order, it changes how you feel a lot. So I went several times and I tried to change, like, I'm going to start from here and go there and then there. And this is the experience, what the art is when you see, because it's in the Abrahamic Family House, it's a mosque, it's a synagogue, it's a church. You see something inside, and there is the unity wall where it have, you write messages, and people from all over the world, from different backgrounds, from different beliefs, they leave like a heart-shaped note, and you write and you start to reading them. Some of them are not in a language that I understand, but you can see like how people, like, it's a canvas of unity. And it made me feel hopeful. It was not art created by an artist. It was a collective collage of people. They just shared this, and it made me feel hopeful. And then I moved to read about what's happening and what's inside. And then you go to the Louvre, and the Louvre is, it's really interesting in Abu Dhabi, with the, especially with the exhibitions that they do. Now they have the Mamluk, which is really amazing, about the era of the Mamluks during the Islamic time of the region. And from a space to space, you see how it's curated, and it fills you, and it changes you how you feel about a certain time in history. You understand what I mean, because it's really, it's unique, because you, it's a loop. You don't enter rooms. It's just, you have to follow a pathway. And at the end of the day, that was my first day. I came to Abu Dhabi after coming from a new sector. It's a new challenge. I love to be in a project delivery phase. I love to be driven by a sense of achievement at the end. So that's why I came. But then, of course, you're coming from a new sector, and I'm feeling anxious a little bit, but hopeful. So I'm arriving with all these feelings to this place, and I leave peace and confidence. And I want to start. I want to be part of the project. I want to make it shape my identity, to have an impact on me. And this is what I see, that I arrived with an energy and I left with an energy. What happened between is the impact of art on me. And it happened through an experience of venues, three different venues. I hope we can deliver the same, we can be part of the same experience where people can arrive and leave with something that comfort them or make them feel hopeful. And it's something that can shape them, or even it doesn't have to be measured, or it doesn't have to be like positive and happy, but it can be inspiring them to think more about certain things. I feel like this is, it might sound like I'm very pragmatic and practical, but I feel this is where I stand at the moment, because that was my very closest experience that I felt, you know, the impact just arriving to me right away and shaping my perspective right away. And I feel like it's still affecting me. I'm very touched by it now. And I feel like this can be something that I hope when people see it, especially when in Guggenheim, where what you're going to see is going to be so inspiring. So you will be inspired by a lot. And we have a huge, amazing team of curators who are shaping the journey inside. And it's going to be something for everyone, that they will be arriving and leaving with thought-provoking experiences, new knowledge, learning. And this is what I hope that they leave with.
And I think that for those who don't understand, I'm not sure if we really touched on it, but the Guggenheim Museums is always a partnership with its museums outside. So it's a partnership in Bilbao, partnership in Abu Dhabi. So just Tell us how that works, because I think that that's a great model going forward. It's not just imposing of the art, you know, it's like they come with their museum expertise in programming, but it's also always a partnership. And I really like the way that is going forward for, as a model for other museums too.
As you said, it's 100% correct. Like, it's the same. It's owned by the government there. The collection is owned by Bilbao. In our case, it's owned by Abu Dhabi. They own the collection. And then we are team. I'm from team Guggenheim, New York, and we have the team here in Abu Dhabi from amazing talents that they have in the Department of Culture and Tourism. And we work with each other every day. It is, as you said, it is Guggenheim Abu Dhabi. It is a unique concept. And it is being developed every day. We have harmony in the teams every day. And we lead with certain things because we navigate unknowns. Like in my field of work, it's like an AI or a Gen AI, how it can be implemented. There is no Guggenheim book. There is no Louvre book. Have certain technologies utilized in when you open a new museum. So it is something that we move forward together with. We learn together about it. And we speak together about how it can be used, and then we move it forward. We have the curatorial experience of Guggenheim, where our team it comes and they present hundreds of years of curatorial studies and research. And then this is where the team from New York here all the time supporting and help with the research. However, certain new fields, we explore it together. There is no guidebook for how to use AI museums. We are building it together. It is happening while we're speaking. And then tomorrow we will be discussing a new initiative that's going to show up. And then next week, by the time I see you again in Paris, there will be hundreds of new ideas that people are approaching us. They want us to present it in the museum. And we will have to see if this is the brand, this is the Guggenheim Abu Dhabi that we want to build or not.
Well, it's really a living lab. And I like to go into the excitement about the finalized building. I've heard Frank Gehry talk about the emotion of a building or the feeling of the building. I mean, we're talking about communicating things that are just so subtle, but you sense them. What are some of those things that they have gone into it?
The idea behind the building itself, it's a dance. So if you see it from, you know, Frank Gehry doesn't like 3D models. Frank Gehry sketches by hand and then makes like folds some paper into shapes and put it next to each other. And this is what you get. And we still have the sketches. We still have the folded papers. And then how you can see in his sketches, it's a dance. It's waving. It's like you go from here to here. And this is the living building. It's a living building because it's a dance between spaces. It's a dance between blocks of spaces and shapes and cones. And you create it, and he visited during the culture summit, but from the people who met him, and actually it's available online, he went and he said the first thing when he got inside the building, he said, I can't believe you built it. It was something beautiful to hear that he managed to see it almost completed. He was visiting during one of the architecture events that we had. He never thought that it would be built. So you can imagine how fictional almost the building looks, and but fascinating that he got to see it and he was happy that it got built. And then it's an inspiring for the future architects, because the legacy is a huge factor for every project. It's the legacy for young architects and for other architects. When you see like a building as fascinating as this gets completed, it inspires hundreds of other architects who have ideas that challenges the norm, challenges what's engineeringly available. And it gives them the space to think and dream more and to feel that it can be possible. And don't be shy. Present more bold ideas that can inspire creativity. Because you can't see this building and walk in without feeling like you want to be creative as well. The senses inside you that makes you creative, the chemicals inside them that makes you creative, it gets triggered when you see something like this being completed. Whether you have like you're an architect, you're a product designer or an artist, just you will respect the challenge and the journey of the people who made this happen. And it will make you feel like I want to also challenge myself, push myself a little bit more and push yourself more. Even if you arrive motivated, it will get you a notch or two up. And this is, I think, the legacy of it. And the design itself, it's, as I told you, it's a dance and it's from inside. It is designed that you can go from a space to another, and then the curators will be discussing this again soon and explaining the narrative behind it. I don't want to step on their foot now, because this is where they have been doing amazing work, and this is where they should explain it, and they will explain it more for sure.
I think so. And it's lovely to know that it is a dance, because also these, you call them cones, but they also seem like a horn, you know, so it seems like a musical instrument in a way, like the cones of light or horns of light passes through natural materials too. We should say that it's not rigid. It feels like airy. And so, yes, an inspiring space. And I should ask you, because I find that you have an interesting journey in terms of, and this is really the sign of a creative mind, is that you're not limited, like, oh, this is my path. I'm just going to go beginning to end. You're open to new experiences coming from sports, going into art, and then the digital storytelling. So who do you think in your life, or teachers or parents or collaborators, that kind of gave you that kind of openness and curiosity? And who were the models for you growing up as a young person that you thought, wow, I want to do something creative like this, even you weren't even sure what it was yet?
That's a very good question. This is a really, really interesting question. I never expected it, and I have to think a little bit about it. But as I told you, I've always wanted to live in the intersecting lines between different sectors and fields of life. I've always wanted to live many lives. And this is when you switch from a sector to another, it's almost like you are jumping from one life to another, or from a sports. I'm surrounding by people who are in sports. I'm covering sports. I've covered the Olympics, and the people in sports, they have certain kind of the behavior. They are always motivated. They're always charged. They have the full power and energy to move forward. They speak in a similar way. And then you move to a certain creative field, like with the artist and the culture sector, and you see that people are kind of similar in a certain way. However, there is an intersection happen. And it reminds me of a French amazing person. His name is Paul Ricard. People would know him. They would know that the racing circuit is named after him. He's the architect of the circuit. And he is someone who also lived many lives. He was an entrepreneur. He was an innovator. He was an artist. He was an athlete. He's a multidisciplinary person. And he is someone that I read about a long time ago and inspired me with his story. And then again, when I met Pierre Rabadan, he is someone also that inspired me. And as I told you, like, I got my first invitation to interview for the job one evening after meeting Pierre. And I went through the interviews not knowing where this is taking me. In Paris, it shaped me, like the amazing people I met in France. You don't meet people who changed careers anymore. Maybe it's something in the past you can see, like you go to on a Wikipedia of someone and you can see that he was doctor and became an engineer and became an innovator, invented something. That doesn't happen anymore. But then you go through Paul Ricard, you will not believe what you're going to read. He has done everything. And then Pierre was someone who was very influential on me, because he is also like, I sit down with him and he introduced me to a cheesemonger. And he says, this is the best cheesemonger in the world. And like, when did he find the time to build the Olympics and follow up on this and know about cheese while you are an athlete, while you are a deputy of mayor of the most influential city in the world? It makes me feel like I want to have this kind of life where you get inspired every day. For since the day I joined, I get inspired every day by a new thing that I see, by a new person that I meet. And this is the most fulfilling I ever feel, when I met someone who inspired me, and then I feel fulfilled about my day. I feel satisfied about my day. And the same was during sports. You travel everywhere and you meet athletes from all over the world, and you can see how they approach life differently, how they get charged, because athletes are much more on the edge a little bit. And then it shapes me to like to explore things in me. Like, I love football. I'm bad at football. I wish I was good, but I stopped, like said, like, this is not for me. I have to find something that I like. And then I discovered when I meet artists now in culture, I see sports differently. And then when I meet people who have been working with artists, I see art differently. When I hang out with the curators here, they make me see things I don't see every day. I've never thought about like noticing and exploring. The philosophy of people are different, whether they are having the same job or not, whether they are from different countries. I work now with a very international team that people from all over the world. We're sitting in the same place. I think we have like 50 nationalities in this museum. I've never worked in such an environment, and it's inspiring. You talk to a certain person from a certain country, you get inspired. And it's, as I told you, it's the most important thing for me is to be fulfilled. And I think I find fulfillment in learning something new every day and being inspired by something new every day. This is why fulfillment means to me. Of course, it doesn't have to be the same for everyone. People can be fulfilled by charity. People can feel fulfilled by teaching kids and being a teacher. Everyone, I think, choose what makes them fulfilled as long as it's noble and it's thing is good. You can shape it as much as you want. If you have to choose one person from the past, I would choose Pierre Rabanne.
Well, that's beautiful. It's an example to us how we can live a beautiful life. And I love that that's true. That's the thing that sports do and the arts do. These are creative, collaborative experiences. And when you see someone going further, it empowers you to go further. And we're just not alone in this journey. Thank you, Amir Hussein and Guggenheim Abu Dhabi, for sharing these intersecting lines of arts, culture, and society. Your example is inspiring. By being open, we can indeed live many lives. And through conversations like these, we can see how museums and cultural institutions are not just places to view art, but platforms for sharing and empowering cultures and exploring the depth of the human experience. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
Thank you very much, Maya. Can't wait to join you again soon. Thank you.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interviews producers on this episode were Patrick Healy and Sophie Garnier. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Katie Foster. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community, exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just follow us on Instagram on @creativeprocesspodcast and send us a DM. Thanks for listening.